Politicians have argued that the very existence of billionaires is a mistake and the concentrated power of the wealthy is a threat to democracy. But author John McGuinness sees things a bit differently. He has a perspective that he lays out in his new book, Why Democracy Needs the Rich. We're very lucky to be joined by him this morning. Good morning, Professor McGuinness.
Delighted to be here.
Hey. Well, between us, we're going to get this right. So, Professor, what motivated you to write this book, and how long did it take to do the research?
What motivated me was the hostility that you mentioned towards the rich. It began, I think, with the attacks on the 1% after the financial crisis. And it's become really a crescendo today, particularly with members of the Democratic Party and some academics, seeing the rich as a real problem for our democracy. And I see them really, I don't deny we have problems, but I think them as a kind of convenient scapegoat. And actually, the rich do a lot that's useful for democracy. And I wanted to make that clear to the public, particularly because I think some of the attacks about the rich are actually not just to diminish their power, but to empower other people like academics and the media. And that, I think, would lead to a much more homogeneous society, much less vibrant with the kind of ideas that rich networks help support.
And you know,
how long it took me to write this book? I would say 3 or 4 years. The idea began with a short article in City Journal, and it got a reaction, both favorable and negative. And my sense as an academic is when you get a strong reaction, both positive and negative, that's something to pursue. The worst thing for an academic's idea is just to disappear into the ether.
We touched on this a little bit already, but a major theme in the book is that the rich, with their voices, offer an important counterbalance to other groups that have a very large voice in democracy. Can you sort of flesh that out a little bit and explain what you mean?
Well, there are a whole group of people who I would describe as professional influencers, the media, entertainers, academics, bureaucrats. By their profession, their job in some sense is to influence our public sphere. This is not a surprise. People since Samuel Coleridge have talked about the clerisy as guiding democracy. After the nobles and the clergy disappeared, there was something that was thought to be some group that needed to guide society. Well, it turns out that these groups, like the nobles and the clergy, are kind of tightly networked, and they tend to have rather homogeneous ideas in our society, rather left-leaning ideas. And it turns out that the wealthy, and it's not a surprise because their wealth is earned in all different sorts of ways, have a much broader view of ideas. And while they don't have a professional interest in influencing democracy, they have the independence and the resources that can be their avocation. And that's very useful to society, particularly to democracy, which depends on a variety of ideas to test out.
Yeah, and as you go through the book, I mean, you spend a lot of time sort of breaking out sort of some of those specifics. Like, you talk about the bureaucracy as a as a force that tends to have tends to lean in a particular political dimension. Can you talk a little bit more about the bureaucracy and why you consider that they fall into what the clerisy? By the way, what is that word clerisy? Where does that come from? It's a really cool word.
It comes from Samuel Coleridge. Samuel Coleridge talked about the clerisy, and again, it's the idea that, of course, there are going to be leading groups in society who are going to replace the nobles and the clergy who, in before democracy, were the leading groups. That's where the idea comes from. I think it's a very useful term because I think we still have the clerisy with us. And bureaucrats, well, there's no doubt that they tend quite strongly to the left. There are studies of that. We have over 90% of their campaign contributions go to Democrats, for instance. And moreover, their interests are different. Their interests, of course, are gained, and this has been pointed out by academics as well. A bigger bureaucracy gives them more prestige. And that's in some tension with a commercial society, which, of course, the rich represent. And it's not that I am arguing that we don't need government regulation. This is not a Randian book. But that different groups have interests, and the clerisy's interests tend to be pretty anti-commercial, which is particularly a problem in America, because we were founded as a commercial republic, And I think all democracies, not only America, thrive when the pie is growing. When the pie is not growing, we have tensions and strife. And so commerce plays an important role. And the rich, I don't want to say are the guardians of commerce, but they are at least the advocates often for commercial life. And that's an important perspective, even if it's only one among many.
Now, you also argue that the rich, in fact, have a wide diversity of viewpoints. And what is your basis for that, and why is that significant?
Well, the basis for that is evidence that the rich change their minds. Sometimes they were for McCain, then they were for balance for Obama. Also, anecdotally, you can see that the wealthy, Musk, strongly support Trump in the last election. Bill Gates gave $50 million to PACs that supported Kamala Harris. So there's a lot. George Soros also on the left. So that's empirical, anecdotal evidence. But there's also a reason to believe that. They make their money in so many different ways. They come actually from very different backgrounds. So it's not a surprise that different religious backgrounds, which are also correlated with political views. So it's not surprising at all that they have a wide range of views. And the most important aspect also is there's no gatekeeper, ideological gatekeeper of the rich. I'm an academic. We academics choose who are going to be academics. And that's a pretty intensely political, a small p, process. And we, not surprisingly, tend to replicate ourselves. Consumers are not interested in the ideological views of who they buy from. And so that's also leads to a diversity of views. So there are structural reasons as well as empirical evidence that the rich have very different kinds of views.
Along those lines, it's a common sort of concept that the rich will simply use their power to drive policies that serve to protect their wealth and therefore increase inequality. How do you respond to that?
Well, again, I think empirically that's just not the case. We have a whole group of people, Gates, Buffett, who are for higher taxes on the rich. It's just not the case that the rich are always for lower taxes. Indeed, there is even a group called Patriotic Millionaires whose whole object is to raise their taxes. Even Mitt Romney, the Republican candidate for president, had a big article in the Wall Street Journal, also a member of the rich, has hundreds of millions of dollars, said, please raise my taxes. So I'm not endorsing that view. But it just shows that it's just wrong to think that there are only people who want to lower and pursue their own interests. And I think it's not only anecdotally or empirically, but it's also structurally. Once you have a lot of money, that gives you independence, even independence from your own money.
And there's a related argument that you argue that that Citizens United and the associated unlimited corporate spending, you argue that that's actually a good thing for democracy, and a lot of people don't feel that way. Can you explain why you think that?
Yes, well, there's just so much confusion about what Citizens United held. Already before Citizens United, the rich could spend as much money as they wanted to get out their messages, and I think there's really no alternative to that. How can we allow the media to spend as much money to get out their messages? We're going to decide only media people have unlimited amounts of fund to talk. But what Citizens United added was that you could use a corporate form to do it. And as it's turned out, the people who've taken advantage of this are not corporations like the Fortune 500. They're very worried, going back to consumers, about irritating some of their consumers by taking strong political positions. Who's used this are nonprofits, and that actually helps people who don't have as much money, because if you are a billionaire already, you don't need a corporation to get your voice heard. You just give spend $50 million to support a candidate, or $50 million to get your issue. But if you don't have that kind of money, your voice, even $100,000 is only going to go so far. So that's why a corporate form bringing together money to combine is actually helps people other than the really rich. So Citizens United is just totally confused. People are totally confused about it. even the corporation at issue there was a nonprofit corporation of a lot of people who wanted to spend money on a quintessentially political matter, speaking adversely to a presidential candidate.
Now, let's just quickly define the terms. What do you mean by rich? What is that net worth?
Well, there's no real clear, it's a spectrum.
Right.
In the book, I talk about this, and I really begin with the 1% or even a little higher than the 1%, because it's the kind of people who have the independence to really not be afraid to speak out and have the independence perhaps to fund a substantial civic cause themselves. So I think we're getting up to $50 million, $100 million in that respect. The others, we have a lot of upper class affluent in society, but they're generally tied to their jobs. They're generally often quite cautious about what they can say. So actually I'm talking about maybe the one half of the 1% as the real rich who I think make a difference in democracy, and it comes from their independence, that they can walk away. They're also not so worried about social ostracism because they create their own networks. I mean, Elon Musk, people want to know Elon Musk even if they don't like what he says.
So you may make a provocative argument where you say, and this isn't a discussion about, you know, are politicians overly influenced by the wealthy? And you say the alignment of politicians with the views of the wealthy may stem less from undue influence and more from the valuable information and feedback the wealthy provide. That feels like you're getting close to saying the wealthy are smarter, so politicians listen to them. What have I got wrong?
I guess I'm provocative in the sense I would say on average, the wealthy are smarter than most. They made their money for some reason in a market economy. They have ideas that make that reason. It's not handed them to the government. My argument only works in a market economy rather than one where things are handed out. But my argument goes beyond that. It's that by making money and participating in the commercial republic, they have very valuable ideas for that. They actually know about what works. They know more about regulations and taxation. There are some academics who point out, well, the rich have different views on average, but they actually know more. For instance, even in the very study which the academic complains that the rich have differential views from the average person, he points out, well, the rich actually know what the rates of taxation are. You might think that it's sort of a premise of having a good discussion of taxation to know something about what tax rates are. So and I think that's true in general about regulation. They're going to be very much focused on things like regulation because that's what they deal with on a day-to-day basis. And again, I want to be clear. I don't want to say it's only the rich who should influence politicians, but I do think they have an advantage in that. And also, if you believe, as I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest, that actually having economic growth is very beneficial to democracy to prevent real divisions and real strife, it's not surprising that the rich, having made some money, have some ideas about how economics works and about how economic growth works.
And that sort of calls up a related question that I know you dealt with pretty carefully in the book, which is people go, well, maybe that applies to those who make their money themselves, but how does it apply to a Walton? You know, so can you sort of talk a little bit about why that argument doesn't resonate as well with the inherited wealth, and also the dynamics of the related concept that the dynamics of those in the Fortune 400 change over time pretty quickly?
Right. Well, my first point is that actually the amount of inherited wealth in the Fortune 500 is going down. And I think that's because of technological acceleration. And I think that's a very important thing to talk about the rich. The rich, I do not think were a bit of more of a problem. We were a problem in a more static society, you know, a society of landed gentry. Well, things didn't change. They could be kind of an entrenched group at the top of society. But our rich, they're changing all the time. And that means not only is it not entrenched, but they're picking up ideas that are related to the way our society works. Internet billionaires, people, AI billionaires. Well, they obviously know a lot about the issues that have made them rich. And so that's a really another value. I think they, in some sense, in a technologically advanced society, they're an anti-oligarchical principle because they change so quickly. And I think that's one of the more paradoxical ideas that I have in my book. But the inherited wealth, so I'm not so negative on inherited wealth. Inherited wealth does other things, I think. People who don't spend their time making money, they often have times to be great patrons of art. And one way of thinking about them is that they are prospectors for society in general. I don't think we can have a bureaucratic committee to choose what's great art. We're going to have people of taste to do that. So one thing I think is interesting about the rich is the alchemy that happens over generations. People make money, and then people spend it, and they often spend it on philanthropy and on artistic endeavors. And I think that's important as well, because they still have that kind of independence to do that that we wouldn't get from government or a bureaucratic committee to try different kinds of philanthropy. So while I think it's a good thing that non-inherited wealth is now much more important, I do not think that inherited wealth is necessarily a problem, because I think they're prospectors, or many of them are prospectors for some of the things that make life more beautiful. They come into the sublime, which I think is an important aspect of any civilization.
And in the book, you spend a significant amount of time sort of laying out the dynamics of wealth in this country, and talk about how the Fortune 400 is changing, Fortune 500 is changing over time. I want to go back to something you've touched on and allow you to flesh it out a little more, and that is the notion that this country was founded as a commercial republic. And why is that so significant in evaluating the role of the rich in our society?
Well, it was founded as a commercial republic because a lot of the people who founded it were involved in commerce, and also commerce was an Enlightenment idea. At the time, this was the idea that was thought to make society a lot better in a whole variety of ways, because the alternative was a much more a society which was dictated by a small group of people. But commerce forced people to do things for other people. And that was really very important. It also created the wealth that one has described. They also thought it made people more peaceable. It made people less bigoted, because people were interested in dealing with one another for mutual benefit. They were less concerned about their religion and other characteristics. So a whole variety of good things came from commerce. And so much of our Constitution is structured around protecting commerce. We have a Commerce Clause to make sure that the federal government can prevent parochial regulations among the states. So it's central to our society. It's not often thought of, again, by the clerisy, which really doesn't come from the commercial side of the republic. They're very concerned, and as they should be, about some of the other rights of the Constitution, free speech and things of that sort. But the rich, I think, are guardians in some sense of this other aspect, which is as important as those civil freedoms with which our country was also founded.
Professor McGinnis, what do you see as a threat to democracy due to the growth of the transfer state, and why are the rich in a good position to respond?
Well, democracy has always had a problem with the fear that people would just use their votes to vote themselves benefits. And I think we see that, and particularly as I can say this as someone who's starting to become part of the elderly class, because the older people vote more. They're very focused on things like that. We actually have a transfer state largely to older people, which is not differentiated whether older people are wealthy or not. I get Social Security, although it's not an important part of my income. And the rich, I think, have a perspective on this because, again, they're not dependent on transfers like this. And they can call attention to the danger. And the real danger to democracy from this is that these transfers are not public goods. And what public goods are things like defense, maybe regulations, climate change, things that may hurt everyone or defend everyone. And what's happened in our budget, and one can see it, is that money for public goods like defense, like maybe research into things like climate change has become a much smaller portion of the budget as transfers have increased. And the difficulty of that is, if particularly if we have a crisis, it's going to be very hard to use money, get enough money to address those public goods. That's the difficulty that we face today. And the rich have a whole group of the Peterson Institute, a lot of programs from AEI and Brookings, have a good deal of programs addressing this, saying how we can address this. And they address with a whole variety of solutions, including, may I say, raising taxes sharply, as well as reforming and maybe trimming some benefits. Again, maybe the benefits for people who are better off. So I think they play a very useful warning role, which is always an inherent problem that people have recognized about democracy as long as it's been around. And so you need an early warning system, and the rich offer that.
Professor McGinnis, we got about 2 minutes left, and can you sort of talk a little bit about what are the conclusions that you hope that the readers come away with after reading this book?
Well, I think the important part is that we have a society in which people of all sorts of different walks of life do something for all of us. And one of the greatest risks, I think, in society is that we have often politicians trying to organize bad passions and singling out different groups as scapegoats for society. I see it actually sometimes with respect to immigrants, right? People say, well, foreigners are what are causing our problems. And then there's another group of people who seem to think, well, the rich are the people who are causing our problems. And I wanted to write this book to say, well, no, that's not true. There are many useful people in society. But the rich have also an important function, not just in making wealth for themselves, but in providing the philanthropy and providing the reminder of how our commercial engine benefits all. Those are functions that they perform on an ongoing basis, and we should appreciate that about the rich, as well as the inventions and all the kinds of things that entrepreneurs and investors have provided us and made our lives better. So they make our social life better as well as our economic life. And that's what I wanted to get across in this book.
The book is Why Democracy Needs the Rich by Professor John McGinnis. Professor McGinnis, thanks so much for spending time with us this morning.
Delighted to do so. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll be right back after this.